Taking time.
Hi, everybody. My name is Doug Rowell, and I am a grateful alcoholic.
Hi, Doug.
Grateful to be an alcoholic, and I'm grateful to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And the reason I say that is, I don't know, to piss off the newcomers, I guess. I love doing this. And you know what? I love being here in San Diego. When I was growing up, I had my dad's older brother retired from the Navy and lived in San Diego. So I have two cousins that lived here. I used to come down here and make drug runs to my cousin Chris down here. And I have never said that from a podium in the past. And I hope the cops aren't waiting for me when I get down. Sobriety rocks. I love that. Sobriety rocks. Look, here's another thing I've never done. A call and response. A cheerleader. I'm not an AA. Well, I am an AA cheerleader, but I've never done this. Let's see how loud we can say sobriety rocks and get it on the recording. One, two, three. Sobriety rocks! I love that. I love that. Because it does. It's just like what, you know, our friend Cliff R. says, we came here to have fun. And that's what it is. I didn't come here originally to have fun. I want to thank Joe for calling and inviting me. And I want to thank our host, mine and Carla's host, Barrett. He's an old friend from farther up north that lives down here, the fun size alcoholic. if you were here last night, just forget everything he said. Well, we're here to have fun, and that's why we come and do this. I want to thank all the people. Leah has been just couldn't do enough for us. I want to thank my sweetheart, my fiance Carla, for coming with me. We have a lot of fun in AA, and we're both sober 22 years. I'm sober about 3 months longer, and hardly means anything, you know, except. Every once in a while, if we have a minute discussion about the meaning of a certain tradition, I say, well, you'll understand in 3 months. And but she is. Carla is as beautiful inside as she is outside, and we just have a lot of fun in AA. We have fun being sober, and just meeting the craziest people. You know that. I mean, half of us should be locked up or dead. You know, and we're just here. I heard somebody actually was in San Diego at the 95 International Convention. Somebody said, "Look at them. We're looking across Jack Murphy Stadium." To like 60, 70,000 alcoholics, and somebody said, look at them, the laughing undead, you know? In God's toy box. God never had a childhood, you know? We're the best he could do for a toy box. And like, I don't know if God's one of us going, watch this. So I'm having a lot of fun. And you know what I noticed a while ago is... they got these screens up here. You know what you can do? You can check out the back of your hair. Like, I'm gonna get one of these in my bathroom at home. It's very cool. I want to thank my friends Walt and Mary from Encore Tapes. You know, I've known them from other conferences. And my friend Beverly is talking tonight after this meeting. And by the way, there's a lot of alcoholics who just figure they no reason to go to an Al-Anon meeting. That's their program, not ours. I really encourage you to go to the Al-Anon meetings, especially the big meetings. They're fascinating. I mean, and Beverly's a good friend of mine, and I mean, Al-Anon's there a little sicker than we are. let's fall in love with an alcoholic, but not drink with him. Oh, no. I said that one time at a conference, and a woman named Mary Pearl was in Al-Anon that was following me, and Mary Pearl got up and she said, I think, she's from Arkansas, she said, I think Doug may be right, we may be sicker than y'all, but that the answer's in the literature. You have a book called As Bill Sees It, ours is called Lois Remembers. And, and my friend Luke is here tonight from the North Hollywood group. My home group is the Winner's Attitude Adjustment Meeting. We meet in North Hollywood. We meet every day of the year at 7 a.m. And my friend Luke is here, who got sober about a year and 8 months ago, I think, at 19 years old. He was still in high school, and he's he's a past secretary, you know, at that group. And I just love watching all this stuff happen. And I didn't come to AA to get a great life. I did not. I didn't expect it. I would have accepted it. I just didn't think that was what was going to happen here. And the thing is, anybody who's new in here tonight, I really want to encourage you to stick here, because you just don't know what's going to happen in your life. You cannot see it. You cannot predict it. Just in this last year, in 2009, a lot of stuff happened that was life-changing things in my own life at 22 years sober. Last May, I was supposed to go to San Antonio to speak at an AA conference, and I was looking forward to it. There's a guy there that I'd been looking forward to meeting for a while, and also I wanted to go to San Antonio and check out hotels for the coming up international convention and stuff. And I was just looking forward to it, and I got a call the day before I was supposed to go. On Friday morning. Thursday afternoon, I get a call, and they said, you know, swine flu has hit in San Antonio. They closed down every public venue. Every public meeting that's happening in San Antonio is closed down, so we can't have the conference. And I was really disappointed. But consequently, Friday morning, instead of being on a plane to Texas, I was just reading my email, and I got an emergency email that said, any chance you can go on June 12th to speak at a conference in Bali? And I said, yes, I can. And, you know, if I'd been on the plane to San Antonio, somebody else would have got that email. But so we don't know. Last year, my sister's 2 years younger than me, to the day, actually. She lives in Wichita. I don't know. I mean, she's not an alcoholic. I know she's not an alcoholic. She's a Wichita school teacher, and she's very active in her church, and we just have different lives. And I was visiting her one time when I was about 5 years sober, and I was going to meetings in Wichita, and I asked, you know, the subject of alcoholism came up, and I said, Yvonne, have you ever had a drink? I mean, do you go out with your friends and have a cocktail? And she said, well, I'll have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's. I said, every New Year's, you know, they call that pattern drinking. And and she, you know, they get defensive when you ask them. And she, not, well, no, not every New Year's. And I said, why would you miss a year? You know, why would you miss your annual glass of wine? And she said, well, I always mean to do it, but, you know, it's New Year's. I mean, the kids are making noise, the dogs are barking, the guns are going off outside. Sometimes I just forget. And I don't know about you, but I know I would not miss my annual glass of wine. I mean, if that was a condition of my sobriety, I could have a glass of wine at midnight on New Year's, and only then, I would be sharpening the corkscrew at Thanksgiving dinner. And you know, I would hardly be able to focus on the Rose Bowl game going 364 days, you know. But my sister this year, she had an infection in her foot, and she went to the hospital to have the infection looked at, and they cut out this little thing in her foot, and they did an automatic biopsy of it, and it turned out to be a malignant cancer. And they went back and looked at her foot, and she had quite a bit of that in her foot. So they ended up, long story short, they had to amputate her leg below the knee. And you know, and I called her. I mean, she was concerned about it, of course, and I was concerned, and there was nothing I could do. But I was talking to her. I said, anything I can do? And she said, no, just, you know, pray for me. And I said, you know what, those steps in front of your house, she lives in this house where they had cement steps that had been settling for a long time, and the rise is like 7 inches and 11 inches, and there's no, and then they're crooked and sinking into the ground and cracked, and there's no rail. And I said, how about if I come back and redo your steps for you? And she said, oh, don't worry about that. I'll get by. I said, so I made a reservation. I went back. I flew back. I took some days off work, and her son and I rebuilt their whole porch. Every piece of wood you pull off of there was a rotten piece underneath it. We ended up rebuilding the whole porch and the steps and the rails and everything. And I got done. It took us about 3 or 4 days. And my sister said, and my sister is a woman who's very active in a church, and she can't do enough for people. And I said, she said, Doug, I can't tell. She was tearful. I can't tell you how much this means to me, that you would come back here, and rebuild all this for me. And I said, Yvonne, it's nothing. It's, you know, it's an honor and a privilege. It's not even anything you wouldn't have done for somebody. And she said, well, I know that, but I thought it was more than you would do. And, and you'll be very proud of me. I said, it's an honor and a privilege to do that for you. What I felt like saying was, bitch, I'm sober 22 years. I'm not the same little asshole that used to throw your sweater in the toilet, you know? used to drive my car on top of your roses. That's not me anymore, but you just, you don't know what's going to go on in your life, you know, and that has created a stronger bond between me and my sister. Last August, I went to talk at a conference in Scottsdale, Arizona, and I knew my friend Carla was coming there, and we were looking for, we've known each other for 13 years and sit two seats away from each other at a Saturday morning meeting. And we went there and we're looking forward to seeing each other. And we ended up having breakfast together Saturday morning, and then we had lunch together. And then we went to a meeting, and then we sat by the pool and hung out. We flew back to L.A. sitting next to each other. Felt good. I said, hey, you want to go to a play next week? And she said, yes, I would. And we've been playing ever since, and it's just, you just don't know what God has in store for you. And if somebody had said that to me when I was new, I would have got up and walked out of the room. You know, I didn't want anything to do with your God or your, you know, your happy life. I just your miracles, you know. and I would have missed so much. I don't know if I would be alive today. What happened to me was I went to my first meeting to see what AA was. I've known about AA for a long time. In 1986, I had a couple of friends who got sober. 1984 and 1986, a couple of friends who got sober. And when you have friends that you're drinking and using with, and they come to AA and they get sober and they work the least little bit of a program, you notice a difference in their lives. And not just that they're not drinking, they're also showing up where they say they're going to be. When they say they're going to be there, they're dressed appropriately and speaking in whole sentences. I was impressed, and I wanted to go and see what AA was in case I ever got so bad that I might need it. In the last few years, I had gotten drunk and skied off a cliff, and 20-foot cliff. It wasn't an accident either. I thought I could do it. I saw the Olympics. It looked like they, you know. And they do like 170 meters or something, 20 feet, big deal, you know. But But they lean way out over their skis, and I find out why they do that. If you don't do that, your skis go up in the air. You land shoulder down, you know? So I was like, I broke my shoulder. I was out of work for 6 weeks. Just got back to work for about a month, and to make it short, I ended up falling off a four-story parking structure drunk I was just jumping from one part of it to another. I thought I could make it. That wasn't an accident either. I'm hanging on the edge of the building going, let's see, I wonder what I'm going to think of to get out of this situation. And what? All of a sudden I saw this building going by. And I thought, this is really going to hurt. And so they broke my pelvis in two places. I exploded my right foot. My pelvis was hit by my foot, which snapped the heel off my foot and sent it through it, through all the forward bones like a bowling ball through a bowling alley, you know. And I had a 0.40 blood alcohol level, which was not a record, but you shouldn't be riding motorcycles and jumping off of buildings. But I had good friends who were bringing me an Irish whiskey and cocaine, never occurred to me to say to the doctors, you know, I know you're giving me Percodan and Demerol for the pain, but I'm also drinking Irish whiskey and cocaine. Is that going to be a problem? I figured none of their business, you know. So it took me 5 months to learn to walk. So when I came to AA, I came to see if I ever needed this thing, if my drinking got really bad, you know. So that gives you a picture, just a, you know, general way what my drinking was like. I didn't sit down at my first meeting. It was a big meeting. It was like 200 people at a Friday night speaker meeting at Valley Presbyterian Hospital in Van Nuys. They had a subterranean community room with carpeted and comfortable chairs. They had about three different kinds of coffee and a literature table all set up, and everybody seemed to be coming in hugging and laughing. I didn't even sit down with them. I stood back in the back next to the double doors, you know, and just leaning against the wall, minding my own business and looking very irritated so people would just leave me alone. But they don't. You know, we don't stay sober leaving new people alone. On the other side of the double doors, there was a guy standing there who was like me. He was leaning against the wall, and he had a beard and long hair. So I thought, we were kindred spirits, you know. We're the cool section. We were so cool, we didn't even talk to each other. We were just like, hey, dude. So I'm sitting there, leaning there, like, leave me alone, you know, and people would come up and say, hey, you're new. And I said, I'm not. Well, I'm new. I mean, this is the first time I've been here, but I'm not new. I'm not. Okay, great, man, you'll fit right in. I said, okay, I need to be more explicit. So the next guy that came up, hey, you're new. And I said, yeah, I was just telling this other guy, I am new in the sense that I've never been here before. It's the first time I've been here, but I'm not new in the sense that I'm a new member, you know. I'm not like a new AA guy, you know, looking to stop drinking. I'm just here checking it out. I'm auditing the class, pal, you know. I'm just, I'll tell you what, you know, I'm not a joiner. I never have been. I'm an outlaw. I'm a desperado, my friend. I'm a misfit, if you must know. I never fit any place in my life. I never fit in school. I didn't fit in the workplace. I don't even fit in my own damn family, to tell you the truth. I'm certainly not going to fit here in Alcoholics Anonymous. Hug, hug, laugh, laugh. Isn't it good we're not drinking? I like drinking. I like it very much. I drank on the way here. And fully expect to drink on the way home. So just don't look around for me. You know, don't look for me next week. I'll break your damn heart, okay? You know, so. Thought I made that pretty clear. He goes, hey, great, man. You'll fit right in. And, you know what I wish I had is Bluetooth. because I see new people with Bluetooth that you can't even talk to them, because if you walk up to them, you don't even know if they're on the phone or not, but they can just start a conversation, you know. Yeah, I'm in an AA meeting, and they didn't have Bluetooth when I got sober. I mean, there's really nothing that says, that I can think of, that silently says, I'm very important. I may get a call any second and have to leave than a piece of electronic flashing jewelry in your ear. But they didn't have it. I mean, when I got sober, they didn't have cell phones. They didn't have cell phones when I got sober. They had mobile phones, but they were big. They were in briefcases, and they were very expensive and very big, and only rich people had them, doctors and producers and directors. They had pagers when I got sober. I didn't have a pager, but they had them, because I didn't have one because nobody wanted to contact me, you know. I mean, maybe I would have had a pager if they had, like, don't come over here pagers, you know. But I would have had a pair. Oh, I can't go there, can't go there. But they didn't. What I had was I had a garage door opener with a belt clip. And, you know, so I could look important, you know, without actually having to be bothered. And it was handy because, you know, you'd be talking to somebody and your drink alarm goes off. You know, your head says, shut up, get out of here, go get a drink. And I could just go, oh, I got to get this. And, you know, and go. And then sometimes somebody would say, what is that? Looks like my garage door opener. Yeah, that's what it is. It's a combination garage door opener, pager, and TV remote. It's the latest, coolest thing. I got one. And so, because people weren't calling me to say, come over. People were saying, hey, don't come over here. I would be like, hey, it's Doug. Are you guys going to be home? I said, I thought I'll come and visit you. And again, no, we're not, Doug. We're just walking out the door, man. I don't know how long we'll be gone. Long time, though. Yeah, don't come over here. Okay. Love you, Mom. And I got uninvited to a wedding. Not like they forgot to invite me or decided not to. They invited me. And then after I RSVP'd, they had second thoughts, you know. I had already sent the RSVP. Yeah, I'm coming. I got them a wedding present. I wrapped it sitting on the dining room table waiting for Saturday morning. And Thursday night, I get a call. Hey, Doug, it's Bob. Hey, Bob, what's going on, man? Hey, how you doing? Are you? How's Carol? Are you guys nervous? Yeah. Yeah, that's why I called. Listen, Carol and I were talking about it, and we'd like for you to not come to the wedding. And I think some people would be offended. Most people would be curious. I was neither one. I totally got it. I thought, good idea, you know. Because we had all been at I already bought him a wedding present. Hell, I'll just drink it myself. I don't care. But we had all been at a wedding the weekend before, and I mooned the bride's mother. I mean, I'm not sure how it is in San Diego, but in Hollywood, that's considered a social faux pas. I didn't go there to moon the bride's mother. I just, you know, it was an open bar reception. That's a good idea. Let's invite all our friends on a very, very big important day and give Doug all the booze he can drink for free. And so I'm sure it seemed like a good idea at the time, but I was a little looped and I was having fun. And the band was playing. They had a live band and everybody was dancing, and I was overjoyed. And I thought, you know what would be funny? To show my ass. And as soon as the band stopped playing, I said, hey! And I really expected the room to burst into merriment, but turned out, I wish you had been there. You clearly see the humor in it, but you could have heard a pin drop in that room. And A couple of my friends, three of my friends grabbed me. They just grabbed me, boom, and they swished me outside into the alley. And I said, "God damn, Doug, what's wrong with you, man? You know, what? What? You mooned the bride's mother. Oops." I thought it was the groom's mother. Come on, lighten up. God, it was at the reception. It's not like I did it during the ceremony, for Christ's sake. And you know, and you, I know this room is full of people that know this look of when your friends and your family, the people who love you the most, just get this give up look. I'm done. And that's the look I got from them. Somebody named me Doug Scusting that night, and held that name for a long time. So, there are people in my high school that still call me that, people that I went to school with. But so I'm at the meeting, and they start the meeting, and I'm looking at the other cool guy across the room and to see what he's doing. I don't know if he comes there regularly or not, or if he's just a first-time visitor like me. But they started the meeting, and some people read some stuff. And I know that during that meeting, somebody talked about themselves for an hour. Here's the funny thing. I don't remember if the speaker was... I know it was a speaker meeting, so I know what happened. I can't tell you if the speaker was a man or a woman, let alone what he or she had to say. And, you know, and it's funny when you do this speaking, it's easy for an alcoholic to start thinking you're some kind of special anonymous person, you know, like a famous anonymous person or something. And because they, well, reserved for a speaker, and they get you a nice room, and they have somebody. Well, fortunately, this time our host was Barrett, so we didn't feel so special. But oh, this is too much fun. But you know, I mean, they give you a fruit basket in your room. We got a basket. Carl and I were digging through this basket last night like kids at Christmas. You know, it's just all this stuff. I heard there's a woman named Celeste that put these baskets together. And they're... yeah. And got fruit and chocolate and crackers and cheese and just all kinds of candy bars. I mean, just... So my, and so it's easy to start thinking you, but I have to remember that the first meeting I went to was a speaker meeting, and I can't tell you if the speaker was a man or a woman. What I remember is that people were nice to me. People said, "Keep coming back." I remember that the secretary said, "We have a birthday tonight for Ruth." Isn't that funny? I remember Ruth's name. Of course, I met her later, but Ruth, we have a birthday for Ruth tonight for 18 years. And I thought, that's cool. They celebrate people's birthdays. And... So I'm looking for Ruth, some 18-year-old tiny hiney, you know, and we're in Ruth, and Ruth gets up and she starts walking up to the front. I know it's Ruth, she's the only one walking, and a woman is 50 if she's a day, and the first thing I thought was, God damn, if she's 18, she should stop drinking. And but not because she looked bad. She didn't look bad. She didn't look bad. She was, you know, made up and coiffed and dressed to the nines. I mean, she looked great for 50, but just a little whip for a teenager. And so I figure, okay, I'm a figure outer. I got it. She's not 18. This is AA. They don't drink. She hadn't had a drink in 18 years. Happy birthday, Ruth. I get it. Okay, so by the time I figure that out, these other younger girls are coming out with a cake. And there was a meeting sort of like this with a stage. And they had a permanent stage with a proscenium and everything. And they had a piano up there, a baby grand piano with a sheet over it and a podium. And these girls were coming out with this cake and candles blazing. And just as Ruth got up to the cake, everybody starts to sing. 200 people singing happy birthday. Really loud and really bad. And they were singing in like four different keys at the same time. Many of them were not even committed to the key they started in, and I thought, God, what? There's a piano up there. Somebody here must be able to play Happy Birthday. It's a three-chord song. I mean, how hard? I could do it. Maybe I had to run up there and pull that sheet off the piano. Here I come to save the day, you know, and get everybody in the key of G. And but then I remembered everyone who talked to me, I told them I wasn't staying. So I got no lines in this show. Go ahead, it's a short song, I can handle it, and keep coming back. And I'm, jeez. So then Ruth gets up to the podium and she says, my name's Ruth and I'm an alcoholic. They said, hi, Ruth, and I'm Jesus. God, I remember my friend, my late friend Scott Redmond used to say, this is some level of lameness I never knew was available to me. And, and that's what I thought. Oh, I got to stay now. I can't leave. Because every couple of minutes, something totally unpredictable happens. And then Ruth says, I want you to know that over these last 18 years of sobriety, I've attended a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous every single day. And a lot of people were very impressed with that. People go, yeah, she does. And, oh, Ruth. And I'm in the back going, you're a little slow, ain't you, Ruth? Yeah, you're not the sharpest knife in the drawer, are you, honey? You know? Because I don't know how long it would take me to get this deal if I want it, but it's not going to take every day for 18 years. I mean, if she had been going to medical school, she could do heart transplants now, you know, so... I look over at the other cool guy, who now I realize I'm here by myself, because he's walking over to me, and he's just got that, he's a member. I don't know why he's standing at the back. He's, maybe he's got the newcomer catcher commitment or something, but he's heading over to me, and he's got his hand extended, and he's got that sunbeam for Jesus smile. All of a sudden, he just turned, you know, and I'm, what? He takes my hand and he says, I'll tell you what, you stay sober a year, we'll give you one of them cakes. Am I in the Twilight Zone? Don't drink for a year and I get a cake? Don't drink for a year and I get a cake? I mean, it seems like you ought to get a car, or, you know, I mean, but so I knew he meant well, and I just didn't want to hurt his feelings. I said, you know, I'm not much of a pastry eater. If I wanted a cake, I'd just, you know, stop at Safeway on the way home. I mean, I think they're like $5. It's not even out of my way. I got to stop and get a six pack anyway. But or I could not drink for a year. Okay, and another thing I remember about that meeting is the secretary at some point, people, blah, 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 and this is our big book, Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the basic text of this program and the only authority on AA. And she said, if you're new tonight, please don't leave without this book. And so I thought, I will steal that book. They had several of them up on a literature table with some other literature, and I was positive I could go pick up that book, act like I've never, like I'm fascinated with it. Look at this. This is great. This is absolutely going to help with my somberarity. And walk right out the door, and I just had a feeling they would say, let him go, even if they noticed. And I could hardly wait to try it. Because, you know, if you get caught, you can say, oh, I'm sorry. But before I could put my plan into action, she said, if you're new tonight and you're financially embarrassed, we understand that. We've been there. We want you to have this book, and we'll make very liberal credit arrangements, including nothing down and nothing a week till you get back on your feet. Which sounds very loving and generous, unless you're going to steal the book. And now I realize that if I steal the book, they'll think I'm homeless. So I do have my pride. I will steal from you, but I will not accept your damn charity. And I don't care if that book is probably $20-25, but I'm going to buy that book tonight. And it's a hardcover book, you know. So I wait till the end of the meeting, and I go up to her, and I say, can I buy one of those books? She goes, oh, the big book? Yeah, the big book. I've seen bigger. How much is that big book? She says, it's $4.65. Do you have it? $4.65 for a hardcover book? Yeah, I think I can handle that. Here's a $5. Keep the change. She said, no, I'll get your change. Hang on. I said, no, please. Keep the change. Use that to help a drunk lady. I'm on my feet, okay? So I get this book and started home, and I stopped at the store and got a fifth of whiskey, and so I had a bottle of whiskey in my book. I get home with my bottle in my book. I poured about 3 fingers of whiskey, and I started to read this book. And I don't mean like I stayed up all night studying the book. I just sort of skimmed it. I looked through it. Some of it I didn't even bother to read. The doctor's opinion. I've had doctor's opinions. to the basic text. Chapter 1, Bill's story. Who cares? Chapter 2. There's a solution. I know that's a sales pitch. That's a sales pitch. There's a solution. I was raised on TV. I see those things a mile away. Young man, there's a solution to your problem. The 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous will give you a life beyond your wildest drunken dreams. Next, chapter 3. More about alcoholism. It sounds like it might be the most boring piece of literature in the English language. Yeah, it's one of those things you kind of expect. I don't know if you had this. When I was in sixth grade, they used to play all these health films. And it seemed like this was like something like that, like it would start out, more about alcoholism. And so, you know, okay, I'll save that till some night when I'm tweaking and feel like I got toothpicks in my eyelids. You know, read more about alcoholism and fade right out. Chapter 4, We Agnostics. Absolutely took me by surprise. I did not expect to find a chapter called We Agnostics. Let me tell you something. When I went to my first meeting, I expected, nobody ever told me this, I had reason to expect that Alcoholics Anonymous was the secular way to get sober, the way smart people get sober without God. My grandmother was a Pentecostal minister who, although she never admitted to being an alcoholic, talked a lot about her drinking, and she obviously was an alcoholic. She stopped drinking when she found Jesus when I was about 5 or 6 years old, and she stopped drinking as a result, and she became an ordained minister. She opened a Skid Row mission in San Pedro, California on Beacon Street. If you know that area, today there's some recovery places around there, and there's Ports of Call, which is a tourist attraction. In the 1950s, Beacon Street was a nasty place. People got killed there almost every night, and there was all hawk shops and saloons and shooting galleries, and my grandmother's little Pentecostal White Dove mission. And she would bring these wharf rats and winos in and save their souls, and along with that, they would stop drinking. So I knew you could get sober on soup and Jesus. I had seen that done. It just never seemed worth it to me. And so when I came, and she didn't care for AA, so consequently I thought that AA was the secular way to get sober, the way the smart people got sober without God. And when I came to AA and heard everybody talking about my higher power and power greater than yourself, and humbly asked him with a capital H and admitted to God and asked God and told God and prayed to God, oh my God, God, the last house on the block is Sunday school, and I just was so irritated. I can't tell you. And I went home very disappointed in that, but there was a lot going on at AA that I kind of was attracted to. I like the hugging and laughing. I believe that the people are there drank like I did and didn't drink anymore. I believe that. But I didn't know if this would work for me or if I even wanted it to. You know, I was thinking maybe I'm the kind of alcoholic who doesn't have to stop forever. Maybe I can cut down, seriously cut down, and have a cold beer on a hot day, or a margarita with a Mexican meal, or dry wine with a steak, or sometimes just get a fifth of whiskey and chug it down and have an inappropriate experience. But it was happening far too often when I went to my first meeting. But I'm reading this chapter, We Agnostics. I'm looking at it. I thought, I'm going to read this whole chapter. This is how the smart people do it. So I read all of chapter 4, and I finished, and I have absolutely no idea what I just read. So I poured another three fingers, and I started reading this chapter again. I read it. I got done. I thought, focus, focus, focus. I have absolutely no idea. I poured some more whiskey. I read it again. I did this about five or six times that night. And finally, I guess the whiskey slowed down my brain where I could focus on the black part or maybe just reading the same piece of literature over and over. But I finally started getting some of what's actually in there. And I came across a sentence that I missed the first couple of times I read it. It says, "We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him." Pretty significant, really. But it's so subtle that I missed it the first couple of times I read it. "We found that God doesn't make too hard terms on those who seek him" is the opposite of everything I thought I ever heard from every sect of every organized religion that I ever heard of. My grandmother's Pentecostal church certainly never said, "We don't think God makes hard terms." If anything, it seemed to me they said, well, for one thing, all the people in that church seemed to call me, say my name in less than a syllable. They would say, "Well, hello. I hope you brought your guitar." And it seemed to me the message over at that Pentecostal church was, "You know, we're very sure that God makes hard times on those who seek him. Boy, you know, God will not even hear your prayers unless you're baptized. And I don't mean sprinkled on the forehead like some Methodist. So that's why we got a tank of water for Christ up here. I'm talking about total submission. Boy, come on up here. We're going to soak you down, pull you up, washed in the blood of the Lamb. Praise Jesus, amen. Somebody get the boy a towel." And and here's me, 14 years old, very self-obsessed, very self-conscious, thinking, I don't know, she told them I touched myself. They're going to drown me. They're gonna send my ass to Jesus tonight for my own good, and I am not getting wet in this room tonight. And I just got to think fast. You know what? I got brand new Levi's on. They're shrink to fit, and... I wouldn't be able to ride my bike home, you know. So I'll be back next week. I'll wear a wetsuit or something, man. I'm so out of there. But it wasn't just the Pentecostals, you know. My girlfriend was Catholic. She had to go to confession, communion, confirmation, a bunch of other cons, to find out how many Hail Marys and Our Fathers were required to cleanse her soul of the various kinds of sins. And I know there's a bunch of Catholics in here. When you hear me say various kinds of sins, I see you shaking your head. Yeah, because they got them categorized over there. If you don't know, they don't have sin. They have venial, menial, cardinal, mortal. Some of them you don't even have to do them if you think about them. Expressway to hell, buddy. Think about them. How do you not think about sin? God, you know, it seemed like a hard program to me. And she would, she and her whole family would go to, you know, that and confession and catechism and genuflection. I don't know. Anyway, I didn't have any interest in it. It seemed like it made them happy. My friend Michael was an Orthodox Jew, which made him and his brother Sherm have to wear spit curls to public school. We're like, "Oh yeah, there's a loving God for you. Thou shalt wear spit curls to public school. We'll make a fighter of you yet, young man." And I don't know. I go over to their house, and it seemed like their mom was waiting for me all week. "Doug, welcome to our home. It's an honor to have you. Would you like to join us for some wine and challah?" "Some what?" "Would you like to join our family in some wine and challah?" "Well, I'll have some wine. I'm not much of a pastry eater." And then there were Buddhists and Hindus and Muslims. Oh, my. So I just said, "Hey, I'm over here. Here's the line. All the religions of the world on that side of the line. I'll stay over here and make fun of them." That's the guy that came here. That's the guy that came to AA. And I didn't have an epiphany when I read that We found that God doesn't make hard terms on those who seek him. But it got my attention finally, and it made me want to come back. There's another part in chapter 4 that I love that says, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis are not easy alternatives to face. See, this is what happens if you say this in an AA function. There's a lot of AA people here, and even some Al-Anons, and there's dead silence after you say, to be doomed to an alcoholic death or to live life on a spiritual basis is not an easy alternative for us to face. Try this. Go get yourself a clipboard and stand in front of Walmart. You know, and stop people when they come out. Excuse me, I'm taking a survey. Would you rather die an alcoholic death or live a spiritual life? And most people, without even thinking, spiritual, and you know, and most people will go get in the long line. Some people might say, am I on candid camera? You know what I mean? They think this is kind of a no-brainer. If you, some earth people, like a very curious earth person might say, okay, when you say alcoholic death, you're talking about where you puff up and turn yellow from malfunction of the liver and choke to death on your own blood and bile and vomit. Yeah. Yeah, you make it sound bad. You know. So, but I tell you, this book got my attention. If you ever do that Walmart test, you know if you find one of us. It's so obvious. Excuse me. Survey alcoholic death, spiritual way of life, and you get this. Ooh. You're going to be here tomorrow. But what happened to me after I read that chapter several times, it kind of got my attention. And it's pretty clear in there that while you are going to need some kind of concept of a higher power, you get to select it. You get to create it, actually. You get to create God in whatever image you want, and that seems to be okay with the creator of the universe. I never heard anything like that before. And like I said, I didn't have an epiphany when I came to understand what it said, but I went back to AA. I thought, maybe this is for me. I've been having some trouble with my drinking. I went back to AA. I started going regular, 5 or 6 times a week. My first 8 months in AA, I didn't have a home group. I was going to a lot of different meetings. I didn't have a sponsor, you know. I really didn't want anybody telling me where I could go and what I could do. So I didn't have a home group, but I didn't have a sponsor. I didn't read the book. I didn't take the steps. I didn't know what a tradition was. I didn't have a commitment. I didn't believe in God, and I was drinking every day. So that was my first 8 months in AA. And except for that stuff, I had a pretty good program, I guess. My old program was keep coming back. That's the only thing I did right. And at one point after I'd been going for a couple of months, I got tired of raising my hand as a newcomer to anybody with less than 30 days, Doug alcoholic. Anybody in the first 30 days, Doug alcoholic. Do we have any new people with us with less than 30 days, Doug alcoholic, Doug alcoholic, Doug alcoholic? And I just finally got tired of it. One day I was sitting at a 5:30 meeting and they said anybody with less than 30 days, and I started to automatically raise my hand, and I thought, you know what, it's none of their damn business. Screw them, you know? It's embarrassing. It's humiliating. People that came in after I am are taking chips, and I'm just not raising my hand. I'm not playing that stupid game anymore. I'll come to your meetings, but I ain't playing your stupid game. That I sat there like this, and this girl down at the end of the table took my arrogance for serenity or something, and she said to her friend, Doug's got 30 days. Oh, geez. So I didn't mean to mislead her, but I realized what happened, so I didn't want to make her look bad. She was on my 13-step list, and please don't misunderstand. My 13-step list was not a list of women that I had 13-step by any means. It was a list of women that I was hoping would 13-step me if I went 24 hours without drinking and I could kiss them goodnight without smelling whiskey on me. But it was a nice little list. I ended up living with one of those women for 15 years in my first 15 years of my sobriety. I'm getting a little bit off track now, but it's kind of an interesting story because Randy taught me how to ask questions. And it's very important because we come in here now. I don't know if you're like this, but I don't like to ask questions because if something in my head says, if you ask a question, they're going to think you don't know the answer. So, you know, duh. I'd rather, you know, get around some people and get somebody else to ask the question, and then when they answer it, go, yeah, that's right. But one night, Randy and I were in bed, and I had my leg over on her side of the bed, and she said, hey, grabbed my legs and threw it like a log. She said, get over on your own side of the bed. God, you sleep like Jim Parks. And I thought, what? Why would she say that? I know that she had a promiscuous past, drunk and sober. I had a promiscuous past. Certainly, I did my share, but I don't bring them into the marital bed. You know, I don't talk about them when we're in bed. I don't know. That just seems rude, thoughtless, inconsiderate, and discourteous. I'm laying there working on this resentment, and I started to say, who's Jim Parks? And I thought, oh, wait a minute. Randy is a voracious reader. She reads everything. She's read all the classics. If I say, who's Jim Parks? She may go, oh, you're not familiar with Lady Chatterley's Lover. Oh, I didn't realize you hadn't read For Whom the Bell Tolls, you know? And so so I can't ask, but I'm laying there. I know my head's going crazy, and nobody knows but me. I'm working on building this resentment that I know is going to get bigger. I'm going to be wearing it like a lead overcoat, and in a couple of days, she's going to say something innocent like, did you mean to leave your boots in the dining room? And I'm going to say, boots! Boots my ass, bitch! Who's Jim Parks? And I don't have to do that. All I have to do is ask a simple question. So I said, I'm sorry, honey. Am I supposed to know who Jim Parks is and how he sleeps? And she starts cackling. She's a cackler. You know Jim across the street? I said, what? What? You know Jim across the street? You know how he puts his truck so you can't park in front of him or behind him without blocking a driveway? You sleep like Jim Parks. So, it's good to ask questions. So, but now I just didn't raise my hand as a newcomer, and I realized that somebody thinks I'm sober now. I said, because she said Doug's got 30 days, and I said, uh-oh. So now I got a sobriety date 30 days before I took a chip. They said, anybody want to take a 30-day chip? And yeah, I got up and took my chip. Hey, it's nothing. Don't worry about it. You know, hey Doug. Said, how do they know my name? Doug alcoholic, and. So now I got the sobriety date 30 days before my first bogus chip. So then I would go other meetings, and sometimes 30 days didn't seem like a lot, or somebody would smell alcohol on me and have to start over, but only at that meeting, or went to this. And by the time I got sober, I had four different sobriety dates at four different groups. Now, I am not recommending anything I did in my first 8 months as a program of recovery. Most of the people who do that die of alcoholism. It's just what I did. And the main reason for mentioning it, well, it's kind of, it's funny, but also, if there's anybody in here who's doing that, and there very well may be, keep coming back. Because you can get depressed about lying to the people who are trying to save your life and go get drunk and never come back. Don't do that. If there's anybody in here who is being dishonest about your sobriety, stick around. If you do, eventually you'll probably get honest about your sobriety. But anyway, what happened to me was one night after 8 months of going to meetings and drinking, and I came home from a meeting, and I was about 10:30, 11 o'clock at night. I'm laying on the floor watching TV and drinking whiskey out of this bottle, and I passed out. And that happened more often than not. I woke up about 3 a.m., bottle's half full, TV's on, turned off the TV, got my bottle. I crawled on my hands and knees through the living room, through the hallway, into the bedroom to go to bed. And some people would call that pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I just called it going to bed. you can't fall off the floor. And I got into my bedroom and I stood up to get undressed, and I fell. I stood up and I fell, and I spilled this whiskey all over the bed, and I'm down on my knees, picked up this bottle, and there's a little bit left, but most of it's in the bedspread. So I set the bottle in a safe place, and I grabbed the bedspread, and I started sucking the whiskey out of the bedspread, and a voice in my head said, "Hey, man, that ain't right." You thirsty, man? There's whiskey in the bottle. No, I'm not thirsty. I'm frugal. I'll waste my life, but I won't let whiskey evaporate in the bedspread overnight. That's a sin. And I looked at what I'm doing. I got no excuse, except I know, I understand I'm an alcoholic, but I've been going to AA for 8 months, and I haven't learned how to not suck whiskey out of the bedspread. And I didn't know what to do. I was out of ideas. And out of ideas seems like a horrible, lost, and lonely place to be. But if you're an alcoholic who's even considering sobriety, out of ideas is the best place you can be. Because it's the release, the surrender, that will let you do the dumb things that we suggest you to do. And I did a dumb thing that night. I said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And I went to bed and I went to sleep. And over the next couple of weeks, every single day, some strange thing would happen. Not some parting of the Red Sea strange thing, some little coincidental. I went in my favorite neighborhood liquor store. There's somebody from AA behind the counter. Everybody behind that counter knew me. But this is a guy from AA who also knows me. "What are you doing here?" I said, what are you doing here?" And I got some cigarettes and I went someplace else and got a bottle of it. I'm in a Mexican restaurant and for lunch one day, and I started to order a margarita, and the waitress is somebody I know from AA. I'm in the Vaughn's Market in the liquor department. Reach up for a bottle. Somebody from AA is pushing a cart towards me. Hey, one day at a time. Keep it simple. think. But this is happening every day, and after 2 weeks of it, I'm on the way to work. I just killed a half pint of Bushmills. I don't keep empty bottles in the car. They're illegal and useless. And I roll down the window. I'm about to fling this bottle, and a guy from AA is driving towards me at 6:30 a.m., and I let go of this bottle just as he waves. And I said, in the bottle, of course, in front of his car, bing, 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 in case he didn't see it, you know. And I thought, where the hell are these people coming from? Oh, I don't know if there's this many sober AA people in Los Angeles County. I mean, they're like cockroaches. Really, have we seen a person fail? And I just pulled the car over to the side of the road, and I sat there. I thought, this is like those stupid miracles they talk about in the program. And as soon as I thought the word miracle, was like I could hear God laughing. And I remembered that I had been on my knees and said, "God, if you're there, please help me." And every day since then, some little strange coincidence had happened. I don't know if it's coincidence. I don't know the difference between coincidences and miracles. Maybe the only miracle, if there was one, was that I recognized that I asked for help. And I got help. But what happened was I sat there in that car that morning and I came to believe. I realized the coincidences were too strong to ignore, and I came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I was at the second step, and I didn't realize it was the second step. I just knew that I came to believe, and I started driving to work, and it felt like a light and a fog came into that car, and I was safe. And it was the beginning of my sobriety, the beginning of my hearing the music of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I went and shared this with all my friends at my home group, and they were, yeah, great, Doug. And I really had like a major Bill Wilson white light spiritual experience. And cool, man, I'm great, you know. No, but I mean, I'm sorry about you guys and your educational variety, you know, but I had that Bill Wilson major white light, and finally somebody said, come here, let me tell you something. You had the educational variety. You were here for 8 months listening to all of our stories. You finally got what we said. You asked God to help you, and 2 weeks later you realize you got the help. That's the educational variety. That white light you thought you saw was your head coming out of your ass. So I started hearing the music of AA, and I think the music of AA is the thing that makes the word make sense. My favorite example of that is when I had 30 days, I went to the Burbank group to take a 30-day chip. My first honest 30, I had enough chips to open a casino by then, but my first honest 30-day chip, and when they said anybody for 30 days, I got up and I said, my name's Doug, I'm an alcoholic. And they said, hi, Doug. And I felt like an AA member, and I took my chip and sat down and watched people take 60 and 90 and 6 months and 9 month chips and a 3 year cake and a 7 year cake and a 19 year cake. I remember it clearly, and I was excited about everybody's progress. It's not in my nature to be excited about your progress if you're ahead of me, but sure. But I was that night. I was high on being sober, and I started to get my coffee break and my coffee at the break, and guy came up and said, congratulations on 30 days. And I said, thanks. He said, you know what the secret is? I said, don't drink, I guess. And he said, no, that's not it. We don't drink here, but that's not the deal. The deal here is hang on. Hang on. Can you do that? And I said, yeah, that's what I've been doing. Keep doing that. You'll be fine. Cool. So now you get 30 days, they tell you the secret. So I'm looking for a sponsee. And, you know, I want to help somebody. And, before I could find a victim, there's a guy at the Burbank group named Jim Baker. He died about 7 years ago, and he was just a fixture at the Burbank group, and he was one of these southern-born glad-hand and back-slapping alcoholics, and he came up and he said, son, congratulations on that 30 days. I said, thanks, and he said, you know what the secret is? I said, yep, hang on, and he said, no, let go. And I get it. I'm hearing the music. I understand that even though they're diametrically opposed, the guy that said, hang on, is talking about keep coming back. Stay close. Stay in the middle of the herd. And Jim that said, let go, is talking about let go and let God. Surrender. The war is over. You lost. You know? It's simple stuff here. But I still wasn't reading the book, and I thought, I don't know, a lot of the words made me crazy, you know, they talked about rigorous honesty, and in chapter 5 that's read at most meetings, it really talks about honesty, and I used to cringe, because before I got sober, the most honest thing I ever said was my first wife said to me, all right, Doug, I want the truth. Did you sleep with my sister? I said, not a wink, and, you know, try not to mislead them if you can help it, but I wasn't honest. I mean, if you're new here tonight and you're looking at this rigorous honesty thing and think, you know, be careful with it. Wear it like a loose garment. I mean, because if you go home and your wife says, honey, does this dress make me look fat? This is not the time for rigorous honesty. This is a time for courtesy, you know, rigorous honesty. No, baby, I think it's the Haagen-Dazs, you know. I don't know, it's a nice dress. It looks fine on the hanger. Let's go try it on the skinny blonde next door. If it makes her look fat, then... That's rigorous stupidity. Don't do that. Waiters say to me all the time, sir, would you like a cocktail before dinner? I say, I lie to them. I say, no, thank you. You know, if I had to be rigorously honest with those waiters, boy, would I like a cocktail? I would like a margarita about this goddamn big and a double Bushmills neat back, and keep them coming. I got a pocket full of plastic party. We're going to party tonight. You know, it's like, no, don't do it. I'm playing with you, because the deal is I have a sickness. I have a terminal illness. It's a mental obsession coupled with a physical allergy and spiritual bankruptcy. You don't want that in your nice restaurant, do you? And, But then I wasn't reading the book, but people at the meetings quote the book. So my feeling was, if I go to, I don't have to, I'm a slow reader. I have a kind of a mild dyslexia, and I read slow. And so I thought if I go, but I have a good memory. If I go to meetings, people quote the book. Sometimes they even give page numbers. And I memorize what they say, and then I'm quoting the best parts of the book, you know. And so that was my plan. But I found out that people misquote the book sometimes. I may have done it tonight. If I did, give me a call. I quoted the book a couple of times. Give me 818-353-4607. Give me a call. You know, I get those calls sometimes, and people tell me if I misquoted the book. Or I'm driving on the I-40, and I'm just listening to your CD, and I thought I'd call and see if this is your real number. 818-353-4607. It is. So anyway. But this woman said, our book says, yeah, I'm all ears. Our book says that our drinking was but a symptom of deeper underlying causes and conditions. It does say that. Well, it basically says that. Virtually says that. But then she went on to add her own stuff without saying, in my opinion, that she said, so if you don't find your deeper underlying cause and condition, you're going to drink again. Now, I thought that was in the book. I didn't know. I'm not reading it. So I got scared. I thought, what? My deep underlying cause and condition, I have absolutely no idea. I don't come from an alcoholic family. My dad is the kind of guy who would buy a six-pack of beer, drink a beer, put five in the fridge, and can't remember if he has beer in the fridge. My mom is maybe an alcoholic. We don't know, because she won't drink. And no, really, if they don't drink, how are you going to tell? You know? And I asked her, too. I said, Mom, why don't you drink? It's after I got sober. Why don't you drink? She said, what do you care? I said, well, I'll tell you, because there's such a thing as a genetic predisposition. And if you're an alcoholic, it might be your fault I'm a drunk. How about that? She said, really? Really? Well, I'll tell you what. When I was young, I did drink. I had friends that drank. I drank. Every time I drank, I got sick, stupid, and obnoxious, so I quit. I said, you got to drink through that, Mom. The promised land lies beyond sick, stupid, and obnoxious. But I don't know what my deep underlying cause and condition is. I never had a drink till I was 18. I didn't start too young. I didn't come from an alcoholic family. I started, excuse me, I started shining the light over, the spotlight over my drinking career. And I, oh, God, how obvious. When I was 24 years old, I had moved from Orange County up to Hollywood to try to make a living in the music business. And I was hooked. Excuse me. I was networking with some people up there, and I started play guitar or bass on somebody's record, or write a song or co-write a song, and I was starting to get a little footwork going. And there was a I was doing pretty good, and a show came to town at the Aquarius Theater called Hair. It was a Broadway show about hippies, and I was a hippie, so it was like a Broadway show about me. I went to see this show, and it was a piece of theater history, because it was the first Broadway show that had rock and roll music. They had a nude scene. They had all these hippies talking about drugs and stuff, and I went to see it, and I just fell in love with the show. And the next day, I called the Aquarius Theater, and I said, hey, I want to be in your show. Now, this couldn't happen today. Today they would say, well, who represents you, and have them call us. And we'll be, but in 1969, it was a different world. I said, I want to be in your show. She said, just a minute, I'll connect you. And I'm talking to the company manager now. And I said, yeah, I want to be in your show. He said, what's your name? I said, Doug Rowell. Can you sing and dance? I said, yeah, I can sing and dance. Now, I can sing, but but I never tried to dance. But I'm up on the bandstand playing guitar or bass. I'm watching people dance. I can tell good dancing from bad dancing. How hard could it be? So I said, and it's a Broadway show, you know, they dance. And I said, yeah, I can dance. And he said, great. What are you doing Friday at 1 o'clock? I said, you tell me. He said, you got an audition. Be here at 1 o'clock, bring a piece of sheet music. We'll see you then. I said, cool. So I'm practicing this. I get my sheet music. I'm practicing the song all week. And Friday morning, I got my guitar out. I'm practicing the song. And I broke a string. And it's hard to explain if you don't understand. But in 1969, it was like, oh, bad karma, dude. And so I went to my roommate's room to see if he had the string I need, and there was a little envelope right on the dresser, a D-string envelope. That's the one I needed. Good karma, dude. So I picked it up, and underneath the envelope was a little white capsule. I said, I wonder what that is. Oh, because we didn't have a PDR. You pretty much had to swallow test everything, and you know, I mean, that's what we had to do. And forget about automotive vehicles and heavy machinery. You know, if you swallow test it, you're going to know what it does. And if somebody dies, don't eat the green shit. You know, it's pretty simple stuff. So this turned out to be THC, a synthetic marijuana, and a nice little psychedelic. So by the time I got down to the Aquarius Theater, I was floating, man. I was like, whoo! I floated up the stairs of the theater with my sheet music in my hand, and I stood at the back of the room. I got this long hair over my shoulders and just swished when I walked, and I got these hip hugger bell bottoms on, big old bells like this, you know, and no shirt on, just a vest with six layers of foot long red, white, and blue leather fringe. Woo, I was a walking wind chime, you know, and I stood at the back of the auditorium with my sheet music, and I watched people audition, and I said, man, these hippies can sing and dance, you know. And I almost forgot what I was there for, and they said, Doug Rowell, is Doug Rowell here? Yeah. And I ran up on stage, and I handed my sheet music to the piano player, and he opens it up, big smile, and he starts to play. Bump, 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 bump. I said, wow, I feel good. And I went into this James Brown number, and I thought I was the godfather of soul, down on one knee and back up, when I hold you, and I finished, bum, 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 wow, bum, 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 wow. I got done, and they said, yeah, we love your energy, man. Can you do something a little mellower so we sort of get a range? And no problem. I went into an a cappella version of Otis Redding's Dock of the Bay, and the piano player picked it up, and we were right in the pocket, man. And it was just like, oh, I could do no wrong. I made myself cry. And and I finished, and they said, great, man, we love you. We just got to see you dance. I said, play. And the guy started playing something, and I started to move, you know. I see my hair coming around. And the fringe on this vest is like, shoo, pow, pow. I'm in a tornado of trails, and I hope nobody minds my mentioning drugs from an out podium of Alcoholics Anonymous. I know I'm supposed to apologize for it, but I can't help it. Part of my story. If I had known, first time somebody said to me, hey, try this, I would have said, God, I'd love to, but I'm going to be speaking at an AA meeting in 30 years. Anyway, I'm in this tornado of trails, and I heard somebody say, Jesus, can he dance? So they hired me. They hired me to go to Las Vegas and understudy the lead role of Berger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. And then we left Vegas and became the first national tour, and they gave me the role. They gave me the lead role of Berger, the obnoxious speed freak, sex-crazed leader of the tribe. It was a stretch, but I could do it. And and we toured the United States and Canada for 3 years, and people would come up to me afterwards and go, I love you, brother. Here, you like pot? Here, Sinsamean, Maui Waui, Panama Red, Acapulco Gold. Give us all this great dope for nothing. Somebody would come up, you like acid? Here, Osley, Purple Haze, Orange Sunshine, Window Pane. Nay, 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 nay. And now that was a flashback. Some girl would come up to me and go, oh, God, I love you. Take me. And go, okay. Yeah. So it was sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and traveling around the country and getting paid for it. It's a good job. But I looked back at it from my newfound sobriety, and I thought, they used me. You don't realize when you're being victimized, you know. So I called my sponsor and said, I found it. He said, what'd you find out? My deeper underlying cause and condition. Oh, let's hear that. I said, hair. Your hair? Maybe, how about if we cut your hair off? You think, no, it's not my hair, not the show hair. I don't know, remember when I told you I was a big star and traveling around the country and everything? Oh, yeah, I forgot about the big star deal. Yeah, but I thought you were loaded when you auditioned for that show. Told them too much. And I said, yep. Okay, well, Yeah. He said, let me tell you something. Most people, non-alcoholics, the majority of people on the planet, when they go to interview for a job they really want, won't take a drug they can't identify. And it sounded right. I said, okay, I don't know what my deeper underlying cause and condition is, and maybe I'll get drunk. And he said, you will. What? He said, you will get drunk if you swallow any alcohol. So, don't swallow any alcohol. Go to a meeting tomorrow. Call me tomorrow. Read that book tomorrow. Read the whole book? No, I want you to start reading that book tomorrow. I want you to start reading it tonight. If you can't read a chapter, read a page. If you can't read a page, read a paragraph. But you got to stay in the middle of it. Best advice I ever got in AA. I started doing that. I never did find my deeper underlying cause and condition. I finally settled on trauma from circumcision. I don't know. But I've been dancing to the music of Alcoholics Anonymous for 22 years and 8 months. And my life has gotten better and better and better. And I'll tell you, if you're wondering what the hell is this idiot talking about the music, I think it's the laughter. We come in here and we start to laugh. We come in here wondering what the hell is so funny, what's everybody laughing about? And when you hear somebody laughing and you realize it's you. And we start laughing and we laugh ourselves weller than we were before we got sick. What a gift that is. If you're new here tonight, I hope you stay. I hope you give it a year. Give it a year. We'll give you a cake. Thanks for letting me share.